Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about happiness and what it is that makes people happy. Now, you might say, well, isn't that a bit subjective? Doesn't it really depend on who you are and where you live? And to some extent, that might be true. However, it is also the case that researchers, academics, scientists have been looking at this question more and more, and indeed believe it is possible to come up with an answer to the question, what is it that makes people happy? And make comparisons between people in one nation and people in another. And it may well not come as a surprise to you if I say that one of the things that does not make people happy is things, stuff, money, having more money. Past a certain point, having more does not make people happier. We'll talk a little bit in this hour of Focus 580 about what does make people happy, as we talk with Richard Layard. He is one of Britain's best-known economists. He's also a world expert on unemployment and inequality. He founded Europe's leading economics research center within the London School of Economics, where he is emeritus professor. He also worked for the British government as an economic advisor from 1997 to 2001, and he is the author of a recently published book, which is titled Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. It's published by the Penguin Press. It's out just recently, within the past couple of weeks. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can seek it out. Also, of course, here this morning on the program, as always, we welcome questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Layard, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
A great pleasure. I'm very happy to be here.
To begin, I guess I would stick with the point for a moment about how it is that people, I'm sure, think about about happiness and the fact that I'm sure some people would react to this idea that happiness is something that can be quantified by saying, well, isn't it rather subjective when the source of one person's happiness is different from another person's happiness? And it's difficult to say something about happiness in the aggregate so that it would make it very difficult to say, well, say something like, are people in Italy, for example, happier than people in France? But in fact, I think you would argue that it is actually possible to provide some answers to all of those sorts of things.
We know more and more about what people are actually feeling. I mean, obviously, the first thing you can do is to ask somebody how happy they are, but you might not believe the answer. Then you can ask the person's friends how happy they think that person is, and you'll find that the answers are quite well correlated between those two sets of answers about a person. Then you can ask an independent observer to observe the person. Is he smiling? Does he interact with people? Again, well correlated. But the big breakthrough has been in neuroscience, where Richard Davidson, actually, from Madison, Wisconsin, has identified areas in the front part of the brain where people have positive and negative feelings, positive in a certain place on the left side and negative on the right side. And those the activity of the brain in those particular areas is extremely well correlated with whether a person says that they're happy or not. It's well correlated if you take the same person and you give them good experiences or bad experiences. It's also well correlated if you compare people. So we do now know that there is an objective thing which is happening when people are experiencing happiness. And we also know positive feelings drive out negative feelings, so that we can think of happiness as just one thing that's one potential thing that reaches from the utmost misery to the utmost bliss. And I think that makes this whole subject one that we can then take very seriously when we're thinking about public policy, for example, and how can we make people happier or help people to be happier.
And do you, I think that this is, I realize this is cutting to the chase a bit, and we want to talk about everything in between, but I guess my bottom line question is, do you think that it is somehow the responsibility of government or incumbent upon government or an activity the government should be involved in and that is doing what government can do to maximize the happiness of citizens?
Well, I think to an extent that's what government have always been doing in a not particularly clearly thought out way. I mean, when they try and stop you being mugged in the street, it's because you're going to feel wretched if you're mugged. So this is not a sudden lurch to a nanny state. It's thinking rationally about what the role of government is. And what is remarkable is that governments increasingly seem to think that their job is to make people rich. And we now have the different leaders of the world, when they meet, bragging about who's got the highest income per head and so on. Although the fact is that if you take the richer countries in the world, once they're well above the breadline, there isn't actually any relation between how rich a country is and how happy its people are. And indeed, we have this shocking finding that in the United States and Britain, when we can compare happiness 50 years ago with now, we find there's no change, although the people are two or three times richer.
Mm. Well, that gets at a central issue, and that is, and it's something that I think that a variety of commentators, psychologists, people who look at society, people who are in politics, have talked about it and thought about now for some time. It isn't particularly new, but that is, maybe we have been mistaken in developing this tendency that we have to associate our well-being with our material things, and to do something, as you suggest, as the way we indicate whether we think we're doing well and our people are happy is what's their income, what sort of material standard of living do they have. And I think that if we, even though we say as individuals that money is not going to lead to happiness, I think somewhere down deep in us we still sort of believe that it will. It's an idea that as individuals we can't quite let go of, and yeah, perhaps that's why government can't quite let go of the idea either.
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think that most people would like to be richer than they are. Mm. And the reason is largely that they're comparing their incomes with other people, and they feel that they ought to be keeping up, or if possible, getting ahead of other people. This is a very deep aspect of human nature. But of course, if everybody is trying to get richer than everybody else, in the end, it's not possible, because a country can't become richer than itself. So that that helps to explain why, in a given country, richer people are a little happier than poorer people. We shouldn't pretend that's not the case. It is the case. But the reason that it's the case is that they're comparing themselves with other people, and that, again, explains why over the last 50 years there's been no change in the average happiness in the population as a whole, in spite of the fact that everybody's got richer, because they've all been getting richer together, and the standard which they feel they need to feel a decent person has gone up. So that's the kind of self-defeating element in the rat race for higher income.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that now we do have some techniques, some scientific techniques to try to measure happiness. It is also possible in a less technological way to simply ask people, are you happy, and then go on to ask them questions about what makes them happy. If you do that, if you simply ask people, are you happy, and they tell you, and then you apply some sort of sort of objective standard of measurement to that, do you find that people are actually pretty good at assessing their true happiness? That is, if they tell you that they are, that they truly are?
Yes, that's true. As I was saying, if you get these different readings on people outside their own report, you find that they're very correlated with what the person themselves does report.
And then if you ask and I guess I'm trying to get past this idea that, you know, our preoccupation with the material things as being an indication of well-being, then if you ask people, well, what makes you happy?
Well, you can do that. A more common way of going at this is to ask people how satisfied they are with life as a whole, and then to ask them how satisfied they are with different things like their income, their family life, their work, their community and friendships, their health and so on. And then you can see how well that list of things, how important those different things that I listed at the end are in explaining the person's overall happiness. And you always find that the top is whether you're satisfied with your close personal life, your family life. Also, high up is whether you're satisfied with work, separately from whether you're satisfied with income, whether you are enjoying your work, satisfied with the relations you have with your colleagues and so on, and your satisfaction with your friends and community. Those come high. Health comes in, of course, at the extreme ends, and especially mental health. I think that probably the biggest single cause of the people being really miserable who are at the very bottom is mental illness, and that's something which is not seriously enough addressed in our society. And income, of course, does come in, no question. But the way it comes in is not just very simply what is your income, but how is your financial situation, which includes, have you got yourself overcommitted? Because the fact is that the relation between whether somebody is satisfied with their income and what their income is fairly tenuous, because so many other things come in, like the commitment you've undertaken, how you perceive other people to compare with yourself, which is affected again by all sorts of things, like how much time you spend watching television. If you watch television longer, it makes you feel poorer. It's a complicated story.
Just maybe one further question. If you do this, if you go around various places around the world, I guess is what I'm thinking of, at least if we're talking about the developed world, and you ask people the same question, tell me what it is that makes you happy, what's really important to your happiness in your life, will you get a fairly consistent list of things?
Yeah, you get pretty similar things in all countries. Yeah, I think human nature, deep inside, is very similar. But of course, you will find different values in different countries, just as you'll find different values in different people in the same country. And values also very much affect whether a person is happy. I mean, if the person is more interested in the well-being of others, they will actually tend to be happier. The people are less happy if they're preoccupied with their own happiness than if they are also involved in the well-being of other people. And it seems to be the case that if you go across countries, countries in which the ideology is more outward-looking and less individualistic, tend to be, on average, happier. And I think, you know, one of the problems with our present situation is that we, and I think the same is true in Britain and this country, have tended to adopt an increasingly individualistic philosophy, where we almost feel that our chief obligation in life is to make the most of ourselves, or even putting it really crudely, to get the most for ourselves, rather than what we can give to the world, which will in the end make us feel less lonely and more satisfied.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening this morning in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hey, good to hear from you. First of all, one thing that makes me happy is contributing to public radio. And I've done so for many years, and I will continue to do that.
Good for you.
Glad to hear it.
But here's a question for you. When I was at the University of Illinois, I first thought about happiness as a discipline to study. I want to say the professor's name was Ed Diener. Does that
Yes, of
me?
Course.
Oh, good.
So no, I mean, he is the pioneer of this subject, the world pioneer.
It's just absolutely fascinating to study happiness. You know, for me, one of the things that I found in life is that there's two routes to success. One, study what the failure people are doing and stop doing that. Two, study what the successful people are doing and do more of that.
Right.
And it's one thing that I think people don't do enough of. But one thing that really, it's always been a question for me. How do you explain people who are happy being unhappy? There are so many behavioral patterns, there are so many emotional patterns that people have where it's an obvious route to unhappiness. You know, the people who are just crabby all the time, the people who, and I would say these are choices. the people who choose to be unhappy, the people who choose to be difficult, the people who choose to not get along, the people who choose patterns that are unhappy, you know, I guess I look at behavior as a function of there's a payoff. You don't do something if you don't get a payoff. So how do you explain, in terms of looking at happiness, the people who choose negative life cycles and what the payoff might be for that?
Well, I think people do make mistakes. I mean, the most obvious case is addictions of various kinds, where people actually know that they should be doing something different if they want to flourish, but they can't get out of it. So I think that you shouldn't overlook the possibility that people get tracked in the wrong direction.
I don't mean we can set the physical addictions and the biochemical brain disorders aside. Set those aside. I mean just the day-to-day. You know, you see the person who's at the grocery store who, you know, doesn't get served quickly enough, so they yell and scream. You see the person who, in their work environment, instead of directly challenging their boss and saying, hey, boss, I'm not sure this is the right way to go, they use passive-aggressive tendencies. You know, these are people who choose consistent patterns of behavior over time that are obviously negative and harmful, and yet they continue to make these choices. I think there are a lot of people who are just happy being unhappy. So how do you explain that? Or how do you address that? Maybe that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, I think that people can have wrong ideas. I think that, you know, we're grown up enough to know that's the case. And the classic way in which psychologists have learned to address that is called cognitive and behavioral therapy,
mm-hmm.
Which invites people to challenge their thought, that is their negative thought, and actually see whether it is achieving the results which they think it is or whether it corresponds to a reality. So the person who is always complaining, he may think that this is the way to make the world a better place, but actually, why not invite him to examine whether that is actually producing an important result, either out there in the world objectively, or indeed in himself, in getting something better for himself as a result of the complaint. I would recommend to people very much this kind of approach to life, which has been developed over the last 30 years, which invites you to kind of separate yourself from your negative thoughts. Just put them a bit outside. Don't necessarily try and overcome them, because they can be a very sort of important and difficult to deal with part of a person. That these thoughts occur. These thoughts may be the ones you're describing, grousing, or they may be anger. Put them on one side and focus on the positive potential, which is actually there in everybody. Invite the person not only to focus on the positive potential in themselves, but also the positive potential in other people, and do their best to overlook the negative aspects and deficiencies of other people. And I think where a lot of thinking has gone wrong, it may be due to Freud or others, is the feeling that we can't make progress unless we can undo the negative side. And so we've got to talk it through. And actually, the talking through of things doesn't necessarily help that much. What helps an awful lot more is to park them calmly on one side. This is a slightly Buddhist point of view, isn't it? But park them on one side and get on with developing your positive feelings, not only for other people, but for yourself. And that, of course, is what they call compassion.
Maybe that's a great way for me to end this my little part here. Let's say you live with a negative person. Let's say you work with a negative person. What are two or three things that somebody can do to help them kind of see the more positive side, or to help them develop a greater sense of happiness that helps a relationship, whether that's a work relationship or a personal relationship? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, and I'll go ahead and sign off. Thank you.
Well, I think what does a lot for any relationship is if a person feels that they're appreciated, and it's quite often difficult to make somebody that you you don't appreciate feel appreciated. But that is probably the best single thing to get over the negative cycle in a relationship.
We need to pause here for just a moment in our conversation, and we'll hope that you wouldn't mind, Professor Laird, just hanging out here a moment or two while you
speak to people like our friend there who's going to give you money.
Exactly so. Now, he obviously got the message, and we know that there are a lot of other people who got the message as well. But here, this is almost our last chance on Focus 580 to do this. It's the last day this week of our winter fundraising effort. And now when we say it's almost the last time, I'm sure there are people cheering. I said, we know. We want to get on with it, too. We want to get back to doing our programming. But we only can do that if people will call 244-9455 and make a pledge if you haven't already done that. Now would be a great time to do that. Jack Brighton here is in the studio with me this morning. He is our chief web guy, sometimes host on this program. Producer emeritus.
That's the Focus title. 580. That title makes me happiest of all, quite frankly. Just being involved in Focus 580, the operation of the program staff here, is just a joy. And it's one of the great things about my life so far. And, you know, we're talking about happiness. One of the best things about working here is the happiness that comes from being a part of a community of people who are interested in exploring issues and ideas and understanding things better and supporting the effort to share that kind of understanding and, you know, lifelong pursuit of knowledge. That's what we're about here. And, you know, that's what I know you're about as people who listen to the station as well. You get a lot from this, and we get a lot from your participation in the show. Right now, we need to encourage you to join us in supporting the financial health of the service here, because it's very tough times for public broadcasting and certainly for WILL the last 2-3 years. You've heard us talk about the reductions in funding. But we make that up by getting you to call our pledge line, 217-244-9455. So far, it's working. We need to keep it working. So let's encourage you to do that right now. David Teal, our program director on our television station here, is in our pledge center. And David, we have a tough goal to reach in just a couple of days to get there.
We have set ourselves a goal of $115,000 for this winter pledge drive. Right now we are at $64,050. So we've made some good progress today. We've heard from 659 listeners, and 157 of those are new members, and we've been trying to reach 300 new members. So you can see there's a lot of money there, or at least potential money that wasn't there before, but obviously a long way to go. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean we go off the air if we don't make the $115,000? No, but it's what it means is the less money we have to work with, the less we can do, the less variety of programs to find that you'll find here, maybe the less locally that we can do.
Well, yeah, and I know as TV program director, you know, you're in charge of, paying for the shows on WILL TV, just as Jay Pierce is in charge of the radio stations here. And, you know, frankly, costs are going up. So we have to do whatever we can to keep the service at the level it's at. I know you count on that as listeners, and we certainly don't want to cut back in any way, shape, or form, because we feel very proud of the service we're offering here. So we need to get you to call and join us if you haven't as a member of the Friends of WILL. The phone number again, 217-244-9455. Please make that call now.
All right. Thank you very much, Jack and Dave. Let me just again introduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Richard Laird. He is one of Britain's best-known economists. He is also a world expert on unemployment and inequality. He founded Europe's leading economics research center within the London School of Economics, and he continues there as an emeritus professor. He is the author of the book Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. It's published by the Penguin Press. He is at the moment spending some time in the United States talking about the ideas in the book. Of course, you can go to the bookstore and find it and read it. Also, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I was thinking back to the little interchange you had with the previous caller, and that if someone had just turned the program on, they might think that you were a psychologist. And once they hear that you are an economist, they might ask this question, well, how is this business of happiness, how is it that it falls into your area of into your discipline, into economics?
Well, my main interest is public policy. And actually, I only became an economist in my 30s because that discipline is more explicitly oriented to the issue of how to produce the greatest possible amount of happiness than any of the other social science disciplines. But, of course, what it is lacking is a rounded theory of what makes people happy. Economics tends to assume that people are basically happy according to how what opportunities they have for buying things or exchanging with other people on a voluntary basis. And what it overlooks is the fact that so many of our relationships with other people are involuntary. We absorb our aspirations, our norms from other people. We get advertised at by other people. We get smiled at in the street or mugged by other people. And we really need a more general approach in which we're combining psychology and economics. And that's really what I was trying to do in this book. Mm.
We have some other callers to talk with. Let us do that. And the next is in Urbana, where we are, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
Isn't there a problem about equating happiness with feeling good or pleasure or euphoria or anything of the kind? You can get that very quickly by taking some drugs. What about Aristotle's point that happiness is activity in accordance with the highest virtue?
Well, of course, as you say, you can get a temporary high in many ways. But the way we should think about happiness is over very long periods of time. So we should just be, as it were, averaging over all our life in the end. Did we have a happy life or not? And those temporary highs are not going to be a big part of the scene. So we should be looking, obviously, if we're trying to explain a person's average level of happiness, and it goes up and down during the day and the weeks, we should be trying to explain that mainly by the more permanent sources of happiness, the more permanent factors that affect happiness, which includes very much, as we were saying earlier on, their attitude to life. It includes their ongoing relationships and whether they feel valued or not by other people, and so on. It's not so far from Aristotle, but I think he wasn't as rigorous as Jeremy Bentham. I'm a follower of Jeremy Bentham, who said, let's think of happiness as a feature of our experience moment by moment, going up and down.
Yes.
But of course, the thing we're interested in is the totality of it over a lifetime. And when we think of the totality of over a lifetime, we're not going to be primarily concerned with short-term pleasures. We're going to be concerned with long-term influences on our character and relationships.
Yes, very interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm just concerned about the popular idea of equating happiness with feeling good, and I think the feel-good approach is rather defective.
Well, I don't really agree with you. I mean, I think people feel good in general because they feel that they are doing something useful in the world, and they feel loved. Those are probably the two most important things that make somebody feel good, and I don't object to the concept of feeling good. I think feeling good is actually the ultimate test of a civilization, is whether it enables people to feel good for most of the time.
Yes. Okay, thanks.
All right, let's go to line two. This caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. The first one has to do with, I think you kind of touched on this, economics and brain chemistry. You know, I'm sure there haven't been any studies, or I reckon there haven't been any studies on serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine levels in the brain and socioeconomic levels, or doing important work, as you mentioned, and feeling loved. I mean, people are so obsessed by you know, whatever, looking good. They're told they have to buy certain products in order to be loved. So that's one question. Then I have another one.
Yes. I think that the study of what makes people feel good has been mainly done on the basis of asking people questions about how they feel rather than measuring what's going on inside the brain. But what we do know about what's going on inside the brain is that it is highly correlated with how they answer these questions. But you can see that it's not too easy to study how different experiences, real-life experiences, affect what's going on in the brain when people are moving around the place that you can't be actually measuring their serotonin.
Right, and certainly.
And dopamine. But we are hoping, in fact, many of us who are really interested in this issue are hoping that Richard Davidson at Wisconsin will be able to devise some sort of a measuring instrument that can be put on a person's head without it being too visible, that would measure the EEG of a person through all the experiences that they have. And that's the first step. Now, then the later step is to get into the chemistry. But if we can measure the electrical activity itself, that would be a huge step forward.
Okay, so then I'd like to go back to Buddhism and Plato and habits and virtue.
Right.
You mentioned Buddhism.
Yes.
And you seem to be talking about something like watering the seeds of compassion or watering the seeds of happiness or watering the positive feelings as opposed to, you know, nurturing that part of, you know, that seems to be what you were saying before. But
exactly.
The previous caller talked about virtue. So I was wondering if you might be able to connect some of these ancient Greek ideas with Buddhist ideas and kind of modern notions of how to implement them.
Yes, I feel that the Buddhist notion is nearer to what has been discovered through cognitive and behavioral therapy. Mm-hmm. Than the Platonic ideal, which has this disembodied view of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that is taken to the extreme by Immanuel Kant, who basically said that you kind of can't be doing the right thing if you're enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a completely unrealistic view of human nature. At first, the body and the mind are not distinct. They're part of the same thing. And second, it's not realistic to expect people to be good to each other without experiencing some kind of an inner payoff. And I think that is what Buddhism is very much saying to you, that you actually, if you practice compassion, you get into the habit of it, it'll be something which makes you feel better behaving well towards other people than you would if you were cheating on them. But unless you're not going to have a society in which people behave well just by the use of reason, they've actually got to feel better if they behave well than if they don't.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the Dalai Lama, but he says that the goal of life is happiness. But of course, one of his great issues or a great central themes is compassion. So those two things go together.
Yes. I think the thing which worries me most about the title of my book is that some people might think, if I say happiness matters, that the right thing for an individual to do is to pursue their own happiness. In fact, I'm saying, if anything, almost the opposite, that happiness matters so much, the right thing for an individual to do is to pursue the happiness of everybody, himself included, but of course in the world he is rather a minority amongst all the other people whose happiness he can affect, or she.
Well, I guess if there's enough people, there might be some kind of vibration in the world. So thanks so much.
All right.
Pleasure.
We're unfortunately this morning we have not quite as much time as we usually do, and we're coming down to about our last 10 minutes or so. And one thing I want to make certain that I ask you to talk about, because you have explained that perhaps your interest in the subject has to do with the intersection, at least in part, with the intersection of happiness and what we know about happiness and public policy. Do you think that there are some things that government can do or should do to foster happiness.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said at the beginning, I mean, governments have actually always been concerned with trying to make a tolerable life possible for people. That's why we have policemen, and this is why we have public education and so on. But I think that particularly recently, governments have become over-obsessed with trying to maximize the national income. And because it's a kind of nice measurable thing. And we've got away from the idea that the basic issue should be how people are actually experiencing their life. Now, if you then go back to what we know about the things which are most important to people, I think it is really important for governments to try and help to make family life possible. For example, by measures that increase parental leave, that probably increase holidays, that promote flexible hours. I think it's also extremely important, if you look at the interests of children, that governments take steps to make people understand how responsible it is to be a parent. I think parenting classes in schools should be a normal thing in public schools. I think also in antenatal classes, parenting classes should be a normal offering, and both parents should be encouraged to take them. That's the kind of thing. I don't think we want a dictatorial state. Dictation is not going to promote happiness, but I think that we need to think of all areas of our life and see whether what the government is doing or could do would produce more happiness. I mean, one thing which obviously bothers me is advertising. I think the artificial creation of wants is not conducive to happiness, especially when it's aimed at young children. And I'm very struck by the fact that in Sweden, they don't allow advertising aimed at children under 12. I think, you know, this is the kind of thing we should be debating. Shouldn't the government be thinking of limiting this kind of thing, which we know puts tremendous pressure on parents, that the child feels they absolutely have to have this and that, which, of course, is absolute nonsense. They don't need to have this and that, but they do if there's that kind of peer group pressure, which we want to offset if we can. I could go through a whole list, but I'm just giving examples of things we might do differently if we thought happiness was the most important thing. I think our healthcare system would be very different because of the importance of mental health that I mentioned to you before. At the moment, in America and in Britain, of people who have severe depressions, clinical depressions, only 10% see a psychiatrist and 10% see a psychologist. I mean, this is a very poor provision. I've got mild high blood pressure. I automatically see a specialist. Anybody with any kind of chronic illness, asthma, diabetes, or whatever, almost automatically sees a specialist, but not somebody with a crippling mental condition. If you thought happiness mattered, that would be one of the most prestigious parts of the medical profession. In fact, if you're looking for something idealistic to do, I think mental health is a place to be.
Mm-hmm. And this all leads me to think about how different governments think differently about the responsibility of government to enact policies that will enhance people's quality of life, and then as a result, the hope would be, the expectation is that people would be happier. And certainly there's a big difference between how governments in the United States have thought about this historically and governments in Europe. Perhaps Britain is a bit closer to the United States. And yet I think there still is a difference between Britain and the United States, and then a much, much greater difference if you would make comparison, say, between Britain and the United States and the Scandinavian countries, for example.
Yeah.
What accounts do you think for that, for those differences?
Oh, I think America has a great tradition of receiving immigrants. It's a big open country. A lot of people were basically almost surviving on their own as farmers and so on. So I think it's actually quite natural and not totally wrong for one country to be slightly more individualistic than another. The countries of Europe are rather settled, much more densely populated. They have more of a common culture that people want to hand on to their children and so on. But I think what is fairly obvious is that the more urbanized advanced countries become, the more the involuntary interaction between people that I mentioned to you before, the more the interdependencies, and the more important it is to deal with the problem of lots of people living together in an anonymous kind of society, unless they share some very strong common feeling and sense of obligation to each other. I think it's really important that we don't allow the language of life is tough, everybody has to look after themselves, to become the dominant ideology. As it is, if you listen to some political leaders, that you get a really peculiar view that both within societies and between societies, life is getting tougher, globalization, everything is becoming, in a way we can't control, more competitive. Firms are meant to be absolutely backed to the wall, whereas in fact they're earning profits at least as good as they have for decades. We don't need this language of toughness. In fact, we ought to be thinking quite differently, that now we have this affluence. How can we use this affluence to promote a more tender way of life between each other, rather than increasingly pit one person against the other? So I agree with you that there are some cultures which are better at this than others. I think the Scandinavian ones are the most successful at promoting a sense of equality and respect and concern between members of the society, and that is probably the main reason why they come out highest in these happiness surveys.
I realize we're talking about some of the same things over and over again, but just as a point to come back to finish up, I'm interested in how you reflect on this idea that, and you've talked about it, and you sort of talked about it in the book, is that the competitive spirit, that is the tendency to measure oneself against another and use that as some kind of indicator of how well you're doing, is very strong in human beings. And I guess we have every reason to believe that that goes back some way in our evolutionary development. And I'm thinking, for example, of one of the anecdotes that you present earlier on in the book, where you talk about a study that was done where you ask people, now imagine you could live in one of two worlds. And in the first world, your income would be $50,000 a year, and everyone else would average $25,000. So you could live in that one, or you could live in this one. In the second world, your income would be $100,000 a year. However, everyone else would get $250,000. So which one would you rather live in? And invariably, even though in the second world, the person's income would be more than it would be in the first, people will say they would live in the first because they would be making more than everybody else.
Yeah.
And sort of on the face of it, you say, well, now, wait a minute. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because you're just giving up $50,000 of income just because you'd like to be able to look around at everybody else and say, ha, I am making twice as much as they. How does one get around that?
Well, I think part of it is attitudes. I mean, human beings have managed to change their attitudes to, as it were, escape from some of the worst features of our evolutionary heritage, and this is where we should be able to do that. But I think another thing, if I may just venture into your tax-cutting debate in this country, another thing we should notice is that the danger we're saying is that people, in trying to scramble over each other, which they can't ultimately do at the the level of society. They are making big sacrifices of family life, time with children, time with friends and relatives and so on, which may well not be warranted. And if you then ask, well, how can we sort of discourage this sort of scramble in the income stakes, it's obvious that the tax system does provide some diminution to the incentive to scramble up, because you only keep a fraction of the extra that you earn. And I have been trying to make the point to my fellow economists that taxes have a useful corrective function, as well as the obvious functions of raising money for public expenditure or poverty relief. This is a third really useful function. And we ought to be saying to the people who want to cut taxes, do you really want people to work harder and spend less time with their children and with their families and friends? Because if they can't put their hand on their heart and say, yes, I do, you can say to them, well, why cut taxes in that case?
We are going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we have just hinted at some of the ideas in the book. So if people want to explore it further, I would suggest you look for the book that we have talked about. And again, the title is Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. It's published by the Penguin Press by our guest, Richard Laird. He is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics and is spending some time now in the United States talking about the book and the ideas in the book. Professor Laird, I want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
No, very great pleasure. Thank you.